I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Time. Some 25 years ago, Errol Morris got a lot of attention after the release of his film, The Thin Blue Line. His detailed investigation into convicted murderer Randall Dale Adams proved the man was innocent. Morris also revolutionized documentary filmmaking. Errol Morris has been obsessed over the last two decades with another man convicted of murder, Jeffrey McDonald. He's in prison serving a life sentence, convicted of murdering his pregnant wife and two daughters in 1970 in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Joe McGinnis wrote about this notorious case in his best-selling book, Fatal Vision, which was made into a popular miniseries. Errol Morris has concluded that Jeffrey McDonald was railroaded and that the case against him was riddled with errors. In fact, his book is called A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. Morris is not alone. The Innocence Project has gotten involved in this case, and later this month, a court will hear McDonald's appeal. Errol Morris is an Academy Award-winning director, recipient of the MacArthur Award, and his new book, A Wilderness of Error, has just been published. And Errol Morris, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
Joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. You're going to be asked this question a lot. Why have you spent the last two decades examining and re-examining this case?
I'm appalled by it. Here is a man who has been living with a nightmare for 42 years. He's been in prison for three decades. And I believe he's innocent.
Why do you believe he's innocent?
Because, and this is why I wrote a book about it, A Wilderness of Error, because there's no evidence to tell me that he's guilty. And because there is a counter-narrative, counter-story, that essentially was suppressed, was neglected. The story of a woman who came forward and repeatedly confessed. And if we believe her story, then Jeffrey McDonald is innocent.
And this is this woman named Helen Stokely. We should actually go back to 1970 and to this horrible, brutal murder. And I think it's important for our listeners that frankly are not familiar with the story to know what happened that day. Can you reconstruct that for our listeners?
This is an army base, Fort Bragg, Fayetteville, North Carolina, February of 1970. An emergency call made by Jeffrey McDonald, a captain, a Green Beret, a doctor in the Army. MPs were dispatched. They arrived at the house. McDonald's family, his wife and two baby daughters, had been brutally stabbed, bludgeoned to death. McDonald had also been stabbed, but was alive. He provided an account that there were four intruders, including a woman, a hippie girl with a floppy hat, who were responsible for the crimes.
In fact, he accused them, and again, they had been apparently chanting things like acid is groovy, kill the pigs, not unlike the Manson family murders of several months earlier.
Yes. The Manson family members were arrested just a couple of months earlier at the end of 1969. And in many respects, this seemed like copycat murders, clearly reminiscent of the Manson family. Now, the prosecutors claimed that McDonald had faked it. He had made it look like Manson family murders in order to cover up his own complicity.
You don't buy it?
To me, it's just as plausible. There's a monkey-see-monkey-do aspect to all of human behavior. But who was imitating whom? Were there hippies drug-crazed hippies in Fayetteville, North Carolina, who could have been responsible for the murders and have been influenced by the Manson family? Yes. That, to me, is as plausible, in fact, even more plausible than the idea that Jeffrey McDonald decided to imitate the Manson family and use it as a cover-up for his own crimes.
And I clearly can't and don't want to relitigate this case. But I mean, obviously, your investigation raises a number of questions.
Well, we are relitigating it. Let's be perfectly honest here. Yes, he was convicted and sentenced to 3 consecutive life terms for these murders. But I believe that the case is being relitigated, at least relitigated in the form of my book, A Wilderness of Error, and is being relitigated in a more direct sense. There will be a hearing at the end of this month in Wilmington, North Carolina, where a lot of this evidence, which was never put before the jury in 1979, is going to be presented for the first time in a court of law.
Have you interviewed Jeffrey McDonald?
I have indeed.
And based, you have done some very famous interviews with some quite famous people as well. What was your sense as you interviewed him? What's he like?
I interviewed him in a federal prison in Cumberland, Maryland. I like Jeffrey McDonald. He's articulate. He's smart. Let's remember that at the time of these murders, he had gone to Princeton. He had then gone to Northwestern Medical School and then enlisted, became a Green Beret. Loving family. What is so peculiar about the story is there's nothing in Jeffrey McDonald's history that would suggest that he was capable of these kinds of monstrous crimes.
I know it just from interviews that I have done with on crimes that oftentimes a spouse or a family member is at least initially considered to be the perpetrator when it comes to a violent crime. Does that, you have worked as an investigator, does that make sense to you?
It does, but just because it makes sense to me doesn't mean that that's what really happened. The only way we can ever know about a case is by investigating it. By looking at the evidence. You asked me about my feelings about Jeffrey having interviewed him in prison. I never wanted this case to be a kind of popularity contest. McDonald appeared again and again on Larry King, for example, and the audience was asked to decide, do I like this man? Do I believe him? Do I think he's telling the truth? To me, that's not what this story is about, ultimately. It's not about whether you like Jeffrey McDonald, whether I like Jeffrey McDonald. In fact, I do like him. But it's a story about evidence and also a story about evidence that was never, ever presented in court. How do you expect a jury to come to a fair conclusion about a case when they're being dealt a deck of an incomplete deck, a deck with cards missing, where evidence crucial to his defense is either ignored, goes uncollected, or is actually suppressed?
And I appreciate that, and there is some evidence that I would like to talk about, but I think also in trying to understand why someone either would do such a horrible crime or was accused or convicted of a horrible crime, Jeffrey McDonald was after a military investigation, they found the evidence against him was not true, and he actually lived in the civilian world for a number of years. He did go on these TV shows and was, you know, acted in a way that maybe didn't prove his guilt, but he acted in I think what could be described as an arrogant kind of way. His in-laws turned against him after these appearances on television. I think trying, for the public at least, trying to understand someone's motivation without going through all the evidence, you see someone on TV and you make an opinion about them.
Yes.
Rightly or wrongly.
But let me ask you a simple question.
Sure.
Do you think that the guilt or innocence of a criminal defendant should be decided on whether they comport themselves well on national television?
No, of course not. But what I'm saying is he might not have done his case any favors by those appearances.
That's absolutely correct. And it's a long, complicated story. But his appearance on the Dick Cavett Show in 1970 caused him a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
I suppose in retrospect, what he should have done was simply talked about his wife and children. He did, but his attention was mostly directed to his anger at the fact that he was being prosecuted by the behavior of the Army investigators, by the CID, by the MPs. And as a result, he incurred their enormous anger and displeasure. He created a lot of trouble for himself, yes.
We're about a minute and a half before our break here. Your book.
Let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Have you ever been on one of those national talk shows?
No, I have not. I have my own talk show in Philadelphia. We're not a national TV talk show, clearly.
It's a feeling of being like a deer in the headlights. How are you supposed to conduct yourself? What are you supposed to say? And what are you supposed to do? And I read very, very little into how he acted on Dick Cavett. Mm-hmm. To me, that's part of the story, but a very, very small part of it.
We're about 45 seconds before our break here, and I have to say your book is clearly you have gone through all the evidence and come to the conclusion that you have. Did you read every transcript, everything involved in this case?
It'd be impossible because
it's so thousands luminous. And thousands and thousands of pages.
But I read a lot of it, yes.
Well, let's take that short – hold on to that. Let's take that short break. We are talking with Errol Morris today on Radio Times. He's a renowned filmmaker, Academy Award-winning director of The Fog of War, recipient of the MacArthur Genius Award. We're talking about not a new film of his, but a book that he has written, and it's called A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald, and it's his investigation into the various trials of Jeffrey McDonald, who was convicted and found guilty of murdering his family, his pregnant wife, and two daughters. And Errol Morris feels that he has been railroaded. Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation.
The Nonprofit Center at LaSalle University announces 60 educational opportunities for nonprofit staff and board members. Nonprofit professionals can develop and expand their skills in fundraising, finance, management, strategic planning, evaluation, marketing, communications, and leadership through full-day classes, on-site training, and certificate programs. Now in South Jersey, too. 215-951-1701 or LaSalleNonprofitCenter.org. The Nonprofit Center supports WHYY.
4 years ago in Denver, Democrats nominated Barack Obama for president.
With profound gratitude and great humility, I accept your nomination for presidency of the United States.
This week, President Obama addresses the Democratic Convention in Charlotte. I'm Mara Liasson. Join us for special coverage from NPR News.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY.
Next time on Tell Me More, we'll hear about the rising stars being featured at this year's Democratic National Convention, and we'll meet the first person to propose a gay rights plank at a national convention. That was only 40 years ago. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just a recap, on February 17, 1970, Jeffrey McDonald's pregnant wife and two daughters were brutally murdered in their home. McDonald was injured, called for the police for help. He said some drug-addled hippies were the assailants. 9 years later, McDonald was convicted of those murders. He's in prison today. He has always claimed his innocence, and his appeal will be heard later this month. Errol Morris, our guest, has spent the last two decades examining this case and has concluded that Jeffrey McDonald was railroaded and the trial was riddled with errors. His book is called A Wilderness of Error, and you probably know Errol Morris, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, worked for some time as a private investigator. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Your examination of this case is that there's a strand of hair that could be important to understanding what's going on. Obviously, this woman that you mentioned early, Helen Stokely, who had been an informant and had both said that she was involved in this and that she had taken that back on the stand. Also, a federal marshal had an affidavit that you think is critical to this case as well. Help us understand why these pieces of evidence are so important.
Well, you tell me. McDonald had claimed that these four intruders had been responsible for the murder of his family. A hippie girl wearing a floppy hat, an African-American male, and two white males, four intruders. Often, he's been ridiculed for this account. Mm-hmm. Crazed hippies. Well, this was a couple of months after the arrest of members of the Manson family for multiple murders. But here's one important detail about this case that your listeners should think about. On the way to the crime scene, one of the MPs saw a woman who answered to McDonald's description. He was in a rush to get there. They did not stop. They did not pick her up. McDonald gives his account. Immediately it clicks. That hippie woman could be the woman that I saw on the roadway on my way here. And then within a number of hours, a woman who had been involved with the narcotics police in Fayetteville, North Carolina, started to implicate herself in these crimes, saying that she was in the house that night when these murders had been committed, that she could have been that hippie girl that McDonald talked about. Now, here's my question for all of your listeners. There's these remarkable coincidences. The woman seen on the roadway, the description that McDonald gave, and this woman's subsequent repeated confessions that she was in the house that night, that she, in effect, was that woman described by McDonald. Repeated confessions that went on for the next 10 years, but which the jury was not allowed to hear.
My understanding is, though, that when she was on the stand, she did not say what she had allegedly told investigators privately.
This is absolutely correct. And one of the puzzling things about this story is that Helena Stokely, the hippie girl, was remarkably consistent. She had told 20, 30 different people that she had been in the house that night. She was consistent except for her appearance on the stand in federal court in 1979. And it wasn't until 20 plus years later that we have an explanation of what might have happened. A federal marshal came forward.
This is James Britt.
Saying that he had a guilty conscience, he could remain silent no longer, that he had been present when one of the prosecutors had threatened Helena Stokely with prosecution for murder unless she shut up on the stand. I'm often asked, why should we believe this federal marshal? Why should we believe this account that he gave? And I have a simple answer. So one of the reasons I believe it is that it's the only explanation I can think of, the only plausible explanation of why she would have suddenly clam up on the stand that day when she had been confessing to everyone and anyone around her that she'd been in the house that night.
It seems, and there is an appeal that will be heard later this month. Part of the difficulty is this is a murder that happened more than 40 years ago. This woman we've been talking about, Helen Stokely, is dead. James Britt, Jimmy Britt, is dead as well. That seems to, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an investigator like you, but it seems to me that would complicate any kind of appeal. Rightly or wrongly.
The evidence is there. It makes it difficult in the sense that this is true of history, it's true mm-hmm. of a criminal investigation, that evidence is perishable. Witnesses die, evidence that should have been collected goes uncollected and then for all intents and purposes vanishes. But there's enough left over.
Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey McDonald is alive, and I'm alive. And while I'm alive, I feel it's my responsibility to bring this story to the attention of the widest possible audience.
You say that he was railroaded. Is that the same as saying he's not guilty or innocent of these crimes?
Part of the story that I've written is how this case was investigated in such a way that may make it absolutely impossible. I'm not saying impossible, but may make it impossible for us ever to know for sure. You don't collect evidence because you don't care about it or you're not interested in it or you believe that the evidence possibly could work against your case. It may be impossible, but I believe there's still enough there that tells us one thing with absolute certainty, no doubt here. Yes, I use that term with conviction. Railroaded. This man was railroaded. There was no real case against him. And the case for him was covered up, hidden, and evidence for it went uncollected.
Did he have bad attorneys?
I suppose it's easy to say when you get this kind of an outcome, you blame the lawyers for what happened. But if you read the book, and I would urge people to read the book, I think it's a new kind of murder mystery. Because it allows you, the reader, instead of my telling you what to think this, think that, think the other thing, it gives you the raw evidence. It gives you interviews with people who are directly involved and allows you to think for yourself about the case. It allows you to be the investigator, if you like. And I think that that's an important difference here from any other book about true crime that I've read.
That's Errol Morris. Sorry to interrupt you there. That's Errol Morris, our guest today on Radio Times. And we're talking about his new book. It's called A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. And Errol Morris, an award-winning filmmaker, has written a book about this very complicated case, raising all sorts of troubling questions about various trials and evidence evidence that was either lost or contaminated or not presented in these various trials of Jeffrey McDonald. Arnold. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. There's something you write in this book, and I think it's probably true in all investigations, maybe in life itself. You write, it's possible to cherry-pick evidence to support any conclusion, and it's possible to interpret evidence to support any conclusion. The idea is that it's kind of like confirmation bias, is that you look for the information or evidence that reinforces the point of view that you have. I would think that's an occupational hazard for any private investigator, maybe anyone doing the kind of investigative work that you did in this for this book.
Well, it's an occupational hazard for everyone.
Yeah.
We've all been treated in the last 10, 20 years to various political stories about evidence and belief. This is not just simply true of a criminal investigation. It's really true for just about everything. Just imagine yourself as an investigator in 1970 in this case. You truly believe, for whatever reason, that Jeffrey McDonald is guilty. So you don't bother to look for evidence that would support this counter story, the story of Helena Stokely. You ignore it, or you avoid dealing with it as thoroughly as you should. This is part of human behavior. You ask me, do I blame the lawyers? Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can point the finger at one person or one group of people. Hence the term wilderness of error, which comes from Edgar Allan Poe, is a true wilderness. It's a story of mistake after mistake after mistake. Not willful, criminal, but all too human. But the end result is truly, truly terrible, truly horrible. And I can't believe that anybody would read this book without coming away with a feeling of how did this happen and how can we fix this?
You also say an interesting thing, that a trial is not a science fair, where there is objective evidence presented, but rather a magic show. It isn't about proof. It's about convincing the jury.
Yes, indeed. And this trial is a perfect example of just that sort of thing. But ultimately, all of us, myself and I believe everybody listening today, believes in proof, believes that there is a true and a false, not truthiness or falsiness,
right,
but real truth and real falsity. If you were a criminal defendant on trial for a crime that you didn't commit, you would deeply care that someone was determined to get to the bottom of it all.
Well, as you know, in fact, in your documentary, The Thin Blue Line, many people either on death row or with life sentences claim that they are innocent. That's not unusual, is it?
It's not as usual as you might think, but it is certainly not unheard of. And when I investigated this case, which culminated in my film, The Thin Blue Line, this was a guy who said he didn't do it, and I didn't believe him. It took me a long time, years of investigation, in fact, before I came to realize he was telling me the truth.
Let me get some callers in. We have, looks like Carl from Old City joining us on Radio Times. Carl, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Marty. I'm a big a fan of the show and a huge fan of Mr. Morris's work.
Thank you.
Because this is an Errol Morris book, I have to ask him if this case led him to any discoveries about the way we tend to investigate brutal crimes in general, anything that we can apply to future efforts of such great implication, or if this is... or if he thinks this case is just a total phenomenon.
That's a good question, Carl. Thanks for calling in. Errol Morris, go ahead.
No, I don't think that this case is unique. It may be unique in the sense that it's gone on for so many, many, many years, and it's produced people absolutely convinced of McDonald's innocence and people absolutely convinced of his guilt. I sometimes think of it like the Kennedy assassination, where you have people arguing endlessly for a lone gunman or a conspiracy. Having said all of that, there still is truth. There's still a real world out there in which things happen. And either Jeffrey McDonald killed his family or he didn't. And to me, the pursuit of evidence, there are trials, there's the justice system, but there's also justice with a capital J and truth with a capital T. And to me, my job is to pursue those things to the best of my ability. Could I be wrong about stuff? You betcha. But I've tried to pursue those questions in this case, and in a way that I hope provides some answers to people who are reading the book.
Are you going to be at that appeal hearing?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Wouldn't miss it for the world.
And the Innocence Project has gotten involved in this case as well.
Yes, they have.
Through your efforts?
Through the efforts of McDonald's attorneys. Here's a man who's had so many attorneys over the years, including a friend of mine, Harvey Silverglate, who was his appellate attorney for well over a decade. There is something deeply wrong with this case, wrong with the result in 1979 in the federal court. But there's another problem. I guess this goes back to the question that was asked. It's a story about how the truth has been overwhelmed by storytelling, by a best-selling book, by 60 Minutes, by a television movie with Carl Malden and Eva Marie Saint. Enormous publicity, which told tens of millions of viewers that Jeffrey McDonald was guilty and that it could be proven beyond any kind of doubt, reasonable or otherwise. Well, I'm sorry. Yes, it went out to tens of millions of people, but that doesn't make it true. It just means that it's going to be damn hard to prove it otherwise.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Talking with Errol Morris today on Radio Times. He's got a new book, A Wilderness of Error, and it's about the fact that Jeffrey McDonald was found guilty of murdering his family. He sits in prison, a life sentence or three life sentences. Our guest, Errol Morris, has spent the last 2 years investigating this case, believing that, concluding that Jeffrey McDonald was railroaded, the trial was riddled with errors. We're going to take a very short break and talk some more and also get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Nearly 250,000 cases of prostate cancer will be diagnosed in the U.S. this year. African American men and men with a family history of prostate cancer are at increased risk. Fox Chase offers a prostate cancer risk assessment service to help you make informed decisions about risk and prevention. It all begins with a detailed analysis of family medical history. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of the Temple University Health System.
On the next Fresh Air, a comparison of the Obama and Romney economic plans. We talk with David Leon Hart, Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize last year for his Times columns about the economy. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Young veterans in Charlotte are finding the sense of purpose the military gave them as entrepreneurs. Anyone from micro-brewed beer that salutes troops? Also, from dueling banjos to I Love NASCAR, the songs that were birthed in Charlotte. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone talking with Errol Morris about his new book. It's called A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Right before the break, you talked about 60 Minutes. You talked about or referenced a Joe McGinnis's book called Fatal Vision. You call him in your book, and this is calling McGinnis, a craven and sloppy journalist who confabulated, lied, and betrayed while ostensibly telling a story about a man who confabulated, lied, and betrayed. Expand on that for us, would you?
I think I was being kind.
Well, be honest. Tell us how you really feel. Go ahead.
The book is an abomination for many, many reasons. McGinnis set out as McDonald's partner to write a book defending McDonald. But after the conviction, he turned the book into something that was the opposite of what he had planned at the outset. A book that has a tacked-on conclusion that he was a psychopath, crazed on diet pills, on an amphetamine, and as a result slaughtered his family in cold blood. The explanation that McGinnis gave, simplistic, was nonetheless compelling, and it was almost carved into stone because it was presented on 60 Minutes, presented in his book, and then presented in a TV movie.
Right.
It's just simply untrue and can be shown to be untrue. It's interesting. When I was working on The Wilderness of Error, of course, I would encounter endlessly people who had seen the TV movie, seen the 60 Minute show, read the book. We're talking about tens of millions of people, all convinced by the diet pills, all convinced by the psychopathy, that this man had to have been responsible for these murders. Again, read the book.
Fair enough. I did read. I mean, it's a big book, and I sped read it. Nonetheless, let me get Francis from Wilmington to join us on Radio Times. Francis, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I read Fatal Vision and saw the movie and was completely convinced of McDonald's guilt, and then read Fatal Justice and had some doubts. So my question is, what does your book bring that's new to the table beyond what was in Fatal Justice?
Francis, thanks for the call. Errol Morris, go ahead.
It tells you not just that this was a miscarriage of justice, and I believe it shows you incontrovertibly that this was not a fair trial. To me, you could argue, I suppose, endlessly about Jeffrey McDonald's ultimate guilt or innocence, but one thing I do not believe you can argue about after this book is whether or not this trial in 1979 was fair. It just most certainly was not. I bring a whole number of stories to view which I do not think have appeared in print before this book. I mentioned earlier that I'm asking all of the readers to become investigators. That's absolutely true. I seize on details. I'm a perhaps an obsessive character. I've been described, at least in one recent review, as a dog worrying a bone. I proudly admit that's absolutely the case. Yes, I am a dog worrying a bone. And I grab hold of various pieces of evidence and scrutinize them and ask you, the reader, to do the same. I think there's a lot of new stuff in this book. And if you have read Fatal Vision and you've read Fatal Justice, I would urge you to read A Wilderness of Error as well.
Why did I know you might say that? Francis, thanks for calling into Radio Times. But what you seem to be saying, and I'm not questioning this at all, which is that there is an objective truth out there. The question is, how does anyone get to that objective truth?
Through investigation, through looking at the evidence. And I believe I have done a more thorough and considered job of looking at the evidence than has been done before.
You mentioned the Kennedy assassination, and in preparation for the show, I was doing some reading about you. Are you working on something on the Kennedy assassination?
Well, I did a short piece for the New York Times called The Umbrella Man, which is available on the New York Times website, which I think is an interesting piece of work. Here's one question that I am fascinated by as an investigator.
Mm-hmm.
Some 20-plus years ago, I make this movie, The Thin Blue Line. I show that a man who had been sentenced to death was absolutely innocent, and I got the real killer to confess. That's the dream investigation. That's the investigation where you have, what's the term, closure.
Exactly.
At the end.
That elusive closure, yes.
You know that this is the way it happened. With something close to certainty. Yeah. Something very, very close to certainty. But that's not true of all criminal investigations. Kennedy assassination is one example. There will be one book after another that claims that they have proven the case with certainty. But I may be speaking for your audience here, but I'm not sure that this case is ever going to have closure. And what is it about a case? What's the difference between a case that somehow sorts itself out in the end and a case which remains some kind of permanent muddle? That fascinates me. And I have an answer, by the way, in A Wilderness of Error. And the answer is that often a case can be investigated in such a way that makes it impossible ever to come to a conclusion. We investigate a case in such a way where we don't collect evidence, where the evidence we collect is corrupted or damaged or lost. And if that's what happens, maybe we no longer can come to a conclusion. We can come to a conclusion about some things, but maybe not that ultimate thing. Here's a very important point, and if I'm just going on at too great length, stop me.
I will, but go ahead. We're all ears.
There's a real world out there. If you were sentenced to death for a crime you did not commit, and someone was strapping you to an electric chair, and you kept crying out, "I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I'm innocent," you would not be satisfied by someone telling you, well, there's really no fact of the matter. Truth is relative. Truth is subjective. There's a truth out there. Mm-hmm. And our job, we may not always be successful, but our job is to go after it, to try to grab a hold of it, to wrestle it to the ground. And that's what this story ultimately is about.
I know you have worked as a private investigator. Do you feel in your heart of hearts that that's really what you do and who you are?
Kind of I do. I never really feel alive except when I'm investigating something. Someone asked me whether investigators are made or born that way. I guess it's the nature-nurture question. I think my own 2 cents worth of opinion is that people are born as investigators and they can never really let go of it. It becomes a lifelong obsession.
which is why this case has obsessed you or kept you so passionately involved for the last two decades.
Yeah, it's the desire to find things out. Mm. What greater kind of quest could there possibly be?
Right, an intense curiosity, I would think. Let me see what Eric from Ardmore has to say. Eric, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. What exactly did the prosecution present as evidence? If their case was that weak, it seems like Mr. Morris should be able to summarize that for us very quickly, but I have not yet heard him do that.
Fair enough. Eric, thanks for the call. Errol Morris, go ahead.
Let me try my best.
Okay.
They presented a lot of forensic evidence which amounted to hand-waving. I remember when I first became aware of the case, one of the remarkable details is that each of the members of the McDonald family had a different blood type. And the blood types distributed about the crime scene were very carefully marked, or it was presumed they were carefully marked. And they were used to establish McDonald's guilt. The only problem is that they did nothing of the sort. It was a kind of legerdemain or hand-waving in court. I ask in my book a very simple question. The distribution of blood in the house, what tells you that McDonald was responsible for it rather than intruders, as he claimed? And the answer is nothing. And we could go through the pieces of physical evidence, piece by piece by piece. What bothers me most about the trial, however, is that evidence was suppressed. Not just the evidence of Helena Stokely and other hippies who also confessed to being in the house, but physical evidence was just simply hidden from the defense and was only discovered years after the fact. A blonde wig fiber is one perfect example of something the defense did not know about during the trial. Helena Stokely said she was wearing a blonde wig, and it was unsourced to anything else in the house. I could go through a long laundry list, but I think the important thing is that, I hate to sound like the proverbial broken record, because I did write this book in order to present evidence and to get the reader to think about evidence. There is a lot of stuff that was presented as a slam dunk proof of his guilt, which is nothing of the sort, and there was evidence that suggested this alternative story of intruders was true, which was hidden, suppressed, and never presented to the jury.
Eric, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Max from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Max, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Mr. Morris's statement that it took a while for him to believe that Mr. McDonald was hadn't received a fair trial or was, in fact, innocent seems to fly in the face of his actions. Why would a person devote years of their life to a case in which a person had been convicted and his appeals had been denied over the course of years? Why would they spend years of their life confirming his guilt as opposed to coming to the case with a belief in his innocence and perhaps, I don't know, maybe it's a little hubris on Mr. Morris's part or attempt to relive the dream of this earlier case that's in the line?
Well, Max,
Max,
hold on, because I want to give Errol Morris a chance to respond, and then we'll hear from you. Go ahead, Errol Morris.
Well, I'm not sure if I heard this correctly. Was the suggestion that I believe that he's guilty?
Huh? That's what I wanted to know as well, Max.
I'm just curious as to why you would, when a person's been convicted and then had their appeal denied over the course of years, why you would devote years of time to unraveling the case, as you might say, unless you, in fact, came to the case with the belief that he wasn't guilty.
That he wasn't guilty.
Well, this, the assumption is that one can't change one's mind. Of course one can. When I made the Thin Blue Line, I had no reason to believe that Randall Dale Adams, who had been convicted of brutal murder of a Dallas police officer, I had no reason to believe that he was innocent. There was something about reading the transcript of the trial. It bothered me. It raised a whole set of questions. I guess that's the investigator in me. And I pursued it. Not because I was convinced he was innocent, but because there was something that bothered me about the nature of the evidence that had been arrayed against me, against him. I wasn't convinced. And as I investigated further and further, I became convinced of the opposite. I found evidence to suggest that he was telling me the truth, that he truly was innocent, and eventually the real killer confessed to me. McDonald is a different story, and I don't see the stories in any way being the same, save for one important fact.
We have about 20 seconds. Yeah, go ahead, Errol Morris.
The story bothered me. There was parts of the story that bothered me, and I felt the need to pursue them and to answer questions that I had about the case.
Well, on that note, Errol Morris, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And the book is called A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. In fact, if you want to check us out on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, you can do that as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.